the above. I overfunction at work. I have advice for everyone, and I'm convinced that my way is best. I distance from my husband, both emotionally and physically, and I assume an angry, blaming position with my kids. If you're having difficulty labeling your own style, use the following as a guide. Pursuers. React to anxiety by seeking greater togetherness in a relationship. Place a high value on talking things out and expressing feelings, and believe others should do the same. Feel rejected and take it personally when someone close to them wants more time and space alone or away from the relationship. Tend to pursue harder and then coldly withdraw when an important person seeks distance. May negatively label themselves as too dependent or too demanding in a relationship. Tend to criticize their partner as someone who can't handle feelings or tolerate closeness. Distancers. Seek emotional distance or physical space when stress is high. Consider themselves to be self-reliant and private persons, more do-it-yourselfers than help-seekers. Have difficulty showing their needy, vulnerable, and dependent sides. Receive such labels as emotionally unavailable, withholding, unable to deal with feelings from significant others. Manage anxiety in personal relationships by intensifying work-related projects. May cut off a relationship entirely when things get intense, rather than hanging in and working it out. Open up most freely when they are not pushed or pursued. Underfunctioners tend to have several areas where they just can't get organized. Become less competent under stress, thus inviting others to take over. Tend to develop physical or emotional symptoms when stress is high in either the family or the work situation. May become the focus of family gossip, worry, or concern. Earn such labels as the patient, the fragile one, the sick one, the problem, the irresponsible one. Have difficulty showing their strong, competent side to intimate others. Overfunctioners know what's best not only for themselves but for others as well. Move in quickly to advise, rescue, and take over when stress hits. Have difficulty staying out and allowing others to struggle with their own problems. Avoid worrying about their own personal goals and problems by focusing on others. Have difficulty sharing their own vulnerable, under-functioning side, especially with those people who are viewed as having problems. May be labeled the person who is always reliable or always together. Blamers. Respond to anxiety with emotional intensity and fighting. Have a short fuse. Expend high levels of energy trying to change someone who does not want to change. Engage in repetitive cycles of fighting that relieve tension but perpetuate the old pattern. Hold another person responsible for one's own feelings and actions. See others as the sole obstacle to making changes. As we have seen, women are trained to be pursuers and underfunctioners with men, except in the areas of housework, child work, and feeling work, where we may overfunction with a vengeance. Men characteristically distance under relationship stress and are excused, if not rewarded, for this style. Both sexes blame, but women may do it more conspicuously than men, and for very good reasons indeed. These reasons include our deep-seated anger about our culturally prescribed de-selfed and one-down position, combined with the taboos against recognizing and directly protesting our subordinate status, as well as our fear and guilt about the potential loss of a relationship. Barbara's blaming, under-functioning position with her husband, who refused to allow her to attend the anger workshop, Chapter 2, was the first of many examples illustrating how blaming both protests and protects the status quo, and how it differs from effectively taking a stand. In thinking about your own patterns of response, remember that none of the above categories are good or bad, right or wrong. They are simply different ways of managing anxiety. You will have a problem, however, if you're in an extreme position in any one of these categories, or if you're unable to observe and change your pattern when it is keeping you angry and stuck. Begin to observe other people's characteristic style of managing anger and negotiating relationships under stress. How does their style interact with your own? For example, if you're an overfunctioner who lives or works in close quarters with another overfunctioner, you may admire each other's competence when anxiety is low. When anxiety is high, however, there may be some head-banging and locking of horns regarding the question of who's in charge, who's in control, and who has the right answers. Why did you go ahead and make a decision without consulting me? The most likely candidates for this pattern might be two firstborns, especially if each has a same-sex younger sibling. If you are an underfunctioner in a love or work relationship with another underfunctioner, each party may be angrily accusing the other of not assuming enough responsibility or simply not doing enough. Perhaps the bills aren't getting paid, or no one wants to get out of bed when the baby cries. When overfunctioners and underfunctioners, or distancers and pursuers, pair up, we've seen the kind of escalating pattern that gets set in motion under stress. Get as much practice as you can observing the interactional sequences in which your anger is embedded. That is, when things get hot, step back a bit in order to keep track of who does what, when, and then what. Observing is a skill that is definitely worth developing before you attempt to perform a daring and courageous act. Choosing a courageous act. Make a plan to do something different with your anger in a relationship, something that is not in keeping with your usual pattern. Using the earlier chapters as a guide, choose one small specific task that you can calmly carry out and maintain when the counter moves begin and your own anxiety mounts. Anticipate the other person's reaction and what you will do then. Even if you don't hold your ground, moving differently in a relationship is the best way to learn about your own self and the relationship. Only after you begin to change a relationship can you really see it. Here are some examples. Breaking out of a circular dance. If you are pursuing a distancer in a romantic relationship or marriage, carefully reread Chapter 3, which describes how Sandra broke out of the pursuit cycle with Larry. If you are overfunctioning for a child, reread Chapter 8, focusing on the changes that Mr. and Ms. Kessler made in their relationships with their children. If you are in an underfunctioning position with your partner, go back to Stephanie's relationship with Jane, Chapter 7, or Barbara's dilemma with her husband, Chapter 2. Decide in advance on a length of time, for example 3 weeks, that you will hold to a new position and see what happens. Defining a self. Think of one or two ways in which you can more clearly define who you are with family members, without criticizing or trying to change them, and without becoming defensive when anxiety mounts. For some of us, sharing our competence and strength is a move toward defining a whole, more balanced self. For others, a more courageous move may be to let others know that we've been depressed lately, and that we're struggling with work or with a relationship. Stating a clear difference of opinion and standing behind it in a relationship where we have been the accommodating partner is another significant move toward defining a self. The more we work on this task, the clearer our thinking about our anger and how best to make it work for us. Moving against cutoffs. If you've been emotionally cut off from a family member, it can be an act of courage simply to send a birthday card or holiday greeting. Keep in mind that people, like other growing things, do not hold up well in the long run when severed from their roots. If you're emotionally disconnected from family members, you will be more intense and reactive in other relationships. An emotional cutoff with an important family member generates an underground anxiety that can pop up as anger somewhere else. Be brave and stay in touch. Moving slowly and thinking small. If you're feeling angry, Think very carefully about what new position you want to take before doing anything. By its very nature, anger propels us into quick action. So guard against this. You will only fall on your face if you attempt to take a new position that you're not yet ready to take, or that you have only casually thought through. Alice was furious with an ex-roommate who had moved to Denver a year ago, but was still storing her belongings in Alice's basement. There was plenty of storage space, but for personal reasons, Alice wanted the belongings out, and was becoming increasingly angry with the excuses coming from Denver. "I can't afford to do it right now. The weather is too cold for me to move my stuff." Alice had a long history of overfunctioning for her ex-roommate and rescuing her from stressful situations. So this scenario was nothing new. After attending an anger workshop that I conducted, Alice enthusiastically rushed home and wrote the following letter to her ex-roommate. "Dear Leslie, I am having a terrible problem with your belongings in my basement. It may be selfish or irrational of me, but for whatever reason, I just can't live with it any longer. If you do not get your stuff out within 3 weeks, I'm giving everything to the Salvation Army. Regretfully, Alice." Leslie did not get her stuff out, and Alice gave it to the Salvation Army. Leslie acted furious and despairing, and Alice, in response, became guilty, remorseful, and depressed. It is not that Alice did the wrong thing. The problem was that she too quickly defined and acted on a position that was not comfortable for her. Katie's struggle to set new limits with her elderly father, chapter 6, illustrates that it often takes time and effort to define a position that is congruent with our beliefs and values, a position that we can stick to without suffering undue anxiety and guilt when the countermoves start rolling in. Remember that women have a long legacy of assuming responsibility for other people's feelings and for caring for others at the expense of the self. Some of us may care for others by picking up their dirty socks or doing their feeling work. Some by being less strong, self-directed, and competent than we can be, so as to avoid threatening those important to us. Changing our legacy is possible, but not easy. Think small to begin with, but think. Preparing for resistance. As you attempt to shift a pattern, prepare yourself not only for intense reactions from others, but also for the inner resistance that you will meet. Elizabeth was a 29-year-old lawyer who had been chronically angry with her parents, who she felt kept her in a childlike role by refusing to be guests in her home. Whenever they visited her apartment, they would insist on taking her to dinner at a restaurant and picking up the check as well. When Elizabeth herself was ready for a change, she found a way to let her parents know that it was important to her to be a hostess to them on her own turf. She cooked them an elegant gourmet dinner that was an undeniable statement of her competence in adulthood, and to her surprise, both her mother and father praised her profusely. The next morning, Elizabeth woke up depressed and with a headache. She was beginning to mourn the loss of the old, stuck-together bond with her parents that protected her from that funny feeling of separateness and aloneness that accompanies our moving from a fused to a more mature relationship. That same week, her father fell on the golf course and ended up with his leg in a cast. You can't be too prepared for the power of countermoves, as well as your own resistance to change. If you are planning to initiate a more adult, person-to-person relationship with a family member, read the chapter about Maggie and her mother, chapter 4, several times. As you think about this book, or discuss it with a friend, you will come up with your own ideas for a bold and courageous act. If anxiety about change is very high in your family or other intimate relationships, you may want to begin working on a relationship that is more flexible and less intense for you, perhaps with a co-worker, neighbor, or friend. Wherever you begin, and whatever task you choose for yourself, here is a review of some basic do's and don'ts to keep in mind when you're feeling angry. 1. Do speak up when an issue is important to you. Obviously, we do not have to address personally every injustice and irritation that comes along. To simply let something go can be an act of maturity. But it is a mistake to stay silent if the cost is to feel bitter, resentful, or unhappy. We de-self ourselves when we fail to take a stand on issues that matter to us. 2. Don't strike while the iron is hot. A good fight will clear the air in some relationships, but if your goal is to change an entrenched pattern, the worst time to speak up may be when you're feeling angry or intense. If your fires start rising in the middle of a conversation, you can always say, "I need a little time to sort my thoughts out. Let's set up another time to talk about it more." Seeking temporary distance is not the same as a cold withdrawal or an emotional cutoff. 3. Do take time out to think about the problem and to clarify your position. Before you speak out, ask yourself the following questions. What is it about the situation that makes me angry? What is the real issue here? Where do I stand? What do I want to accomplish? Who is responsible for what? What, specifically, do I want to change? What are the things I will and will not do? 4. Don't use below-the-belt tactics. These include blaming, interpreting, diagnosing, labeling, analyzing, preaching, moralizing, ordering, warning, interrogating, ridiculing, and lecturing. Don't put the other person down. 5. Do speak in I language. Learn to say, "I think," "I feel," "I fear," "I want." A true I statement says something about the self without criticizing or blaming the other person, and without holding the other person responsible for our feelings or reactions. Watch out for disguised you statements or pseudo-I statements. I think you are controlling and self-centered. 6. Don't make vague requests. I want you to be more sensitive to my needs. Let the other person know specifically what you want. The best way that you can help me now is simply to listen. I really don't want advice at this time. Don't expect people to anticipate your needs or do things that you have not requested. Even those who love you can't read your mind. 7. Do try to appreciate the fact that people are different. We move away from fused relationships when we recognize that there are as many ways of seeing the world as there are people in it. If you're fighting about who has the truth, you may be missing the point. Different perspectives and ways of reacting do not necessarily mean that one person is right and the other wrong. 8. Don't participate in intellectual arguments that go nowhere. Don't spin your wheels trying to convince others of the rightness of your position. If the other person is not hearing you, simply say, "Well, it may sound crazy to you, but this is how I feel." Or, "I understand that you disagree, but I guess we see it differently." 9. Do recognize that each person is responsible for his or her own behavior. Don't blame your dad's new wife because she won't let him be close to you. If you're angry about the distance between you and your dad, it is your responsibility to find a new way to approach the situation. Your dad's behavior is his responsibility, not his wife's. 10. Don't tell another person what she or he thinks or feels or should think or feel. If another person gets angry in reaction to a change you make, don't criticize their feelings or tell them they have no right to be angry. Better to say, "I understand that you're angry, and if I were in your shoes, perhaps I'd be angry too. But I've thought it over, and this is my decision." Remember that one person's right to be angry does not mean that the other person is to blame. 11. Do try to avoid speaking through a third party. If you're angry with your brother's behavior, don't say, "I think my daughter felt terrible when you didn't find the time to come to her school play." Instead, try, "I was upset when you didn't come. You're important to me, and I really wanted you to be there." 12. Don't expect change to come about from hit-and-run confrontations. Change occurs slowly in close relationships. If you make even a small change, you will be tested many times to see if you really mean it. Don't get discouraged if you fall on your face several times as you try to put theory into practice. You may find that you start out fine, but then blow it when things heat up. Getting derailed is just part of the process, so be patient with yourself. You'll have many opportunities to get back on track and try again. Of course, most important of all is our ability to take responsibility for our own part in maintaining the very patterns that evoke our anger. Triangles are the most complex relationship patterns to get a handle on. So let's move on to review this subject. No more gossiping. If you're angry at Sue, is she the first or the last person to know about it? If you're irritated by your father's behavior, do you deal with him directly, or do you go tell your mother? Do you pick up your phone to call your daughter if you're angry with your ex-husband or your son? If you're angry that your co-worker is not doing her work, do you tell her directly, or do you talk to her supervisor behind her back in order to express your concern about her work? When two people gossip, they're having a relationship at the expense of a third party. That's a variation of the triangle. Because triangles lower anxiety, they're not necessarily problematic when they are transient and flexible. When a triangle becomes rigidly entrenched in a family, friendship, or work situation such that it interferes with healthy person-to-person relationships, then the connecting legs must be broken. Triangles at work. Suppose, for example, that you're angry at Sue at the office because she takes extra long coffee breaks, and as a result, additional work falls into your lap. You try to talk to Sue about it, but her first response is to get angry and defensive. You then stop Sally in the hallway and invite Sally to agree with you that Sue is selfish and unfair. If Sally listens sympathetically, your anxiety diminishes. Perhaps this helps you to calm down and think more clearly about how to go back to Sue and manage your relationship with her. This would be an example of a transient triangle with no particular cost to anybody. On the other hand, suppose that you and Sally continue to talk about Sue behind her back. This deflects you from dealing directly with Sue to work out the problem. You will feel closer to Sally because of Sue's outside position, and in this way you detour your anger rather than deal with it. If the triangle continues to persist over time, any one of the following is likely to occur. Sally's relationship with Sue will be influenced by the unresolved issues between you and Sue. For example, Sally may become more distant from Sue or more reactive to her. If Sally begins to like Sue, she, Sally, may feel disloyal to you. Sue's anxiety will rise, and she may begin to underfunction more at work. The more that two people talk about an underfunctioning individual, rather than each working directly on that relationship, the more that party will have to work even harder to gain competence. You will have increasing difficulty calmly and clearly negotiating your differences with Sue and maximizing the chances that the two of you will have the most comfortable work relationship possible. Can't it be helpful to talk with Sally if you're angry with Sue? If your intention is to get Sally's perspective on your problem, and if Sally is able to provide it without taking sides, diagnosing or criticizing either one of you, then a triangle will be avoided. More typically, however, we may begin with the virtuous intentions of clarifying the problem and trying to understand why someone is performing poorly, only to have our efforts turn into mutual criticizing sessions and the start of an entrenched triangle. It never helps anybody's performance to talk about them rather than to them. The more other people get involved in the conflict between you and another person, the less likely you'll be to resolve it with minimal anxiety and maximum clarity. Here are a few do's and don'ts to help you avoid setting up triangles at work. The following advice holds for a friendship or a family situation as well. 1. If you are angry with someone, that's the person you should tell. Even if Sue is resistant, rebellious, or rude, she is still the person to deal with. And dealing with her doesn't necessarily mean venting your anger at her. It means making use of everything that you've learned in this book, not with a third party, but directly with Sue. 2. If you want to go up the hierarchy with your anger, make sure to go through the appropriate channels and be open about it. For example, suppose that Karen, Chapter 5, asked her boss to change her job rating from very satisfactory to superior, and he refused. If Karen wants a third party to review her evaluation, she can find out what the acceptable procedure is and tell her boss that she plans to go over his head and why. If you're open about bringing in another party and you make sure to use the appropriate hierarchy, you may avoid forming a triangle that will escalate anger and stress in the long run. 3. When you're angry, speak in your own voice. Whether you are addressing a subordinate or a superior, don't bring in an anonymous third party by saying, "Other people think you're difficult to work with," or "There have been some complaints about your attitude." Nameless, faceless criticism increases anxiety and is neither fair nor helpful. If you have an issue with someone, use the word I. I think, I feel, I want, I am concerned. Let other people speak for themselves. 4. Avoid secrets. If you believe that it's your job to let someone, Esther, know that she is being criticized or gossiped about, "Esther, I want you to know that Tom is telling people that you are alienating customers." Understand that Esther may want to go directly to the gossiping party to clarify the problem. If you plan to swear someone to secrecy, "Esther, please don't mention anything to Tom, or he'll know I said something to you." Better to say nothing at all. 5. Don't become the third party in someone else's triangle. If someone complains to you, you can listen sympathetically, but without blaming or taking sides. Often this doesn't occur to us, but with practice it's not hard to do. Remember that the best reason to avoid quickly becoming someone's emotional ally is that others have the best chance of working out their own anger and negotiating their differences if you stay calm, stay out, and stay emotionally connected. This concerned but neutral position is in the long run the most supportive one to take, for it helps facilitate creative problem-solving in others. Suppose, for example, that you are supervising Esther, and Tom is complaining to you that she is rude to her customers. You can first encourage Tom to deal with her directly. If Tom says, "But I told her twice and she doesn't listen," you might tease him a bit and encourage him to grab Esther by the collar and try a third time. Or when you see Esther, you might say lightly, "Hey, I think Tom has a gripe about you. Why don't you meet with him and straighten it out?" If you can maintain a low-keyed, non-reactive, non-critical position and express confidence that both parties can work out their difficulties, chances are that Esther and Tom will do surprisingly well. Triangles begin at home. You have just finished cleaning up your kitchen when the phone rings. It's your mother calling, and she sounds quite worked up. "Let me tell you what your brother Joe is doing now. He's drinking again, and he's about to lose another job. I wonder if he'll ever grow up and find himself." Or, "I'm so upset that your father will not pay any of your sister's college tuition. He's always been cheap, and since he married Debbie, the situation is even worse." What do you do? Position 1. You join your mother in her anger and criticalness. Or perhaps you listen sympathetically and then spend the next 10 minutes talking with her about Joe's emotional problems or your father's penny-pinching. Position 2. You come to the other person's defense. "Well, mother, if you didn't keep bailing Joe out, he wouldn't be in such a mess." Or, "I really don't think you appreciate Dad's financial situation right now." Position 3. You give advice, doing your best to stay neutral. You may attempt to explain the behavior of each party to the other, or try to help your mother to be more objective or reasonable. Position 4. You clutch inside and feel very angry at your mother for putting you in this position. You silently decide that you will avoid her as much as possible because she's so difficult to deal with. Perhaps you make plans to move to Alaska. Can you find yourself in one or more of the above responses? Let's look at each position more carefully. Position 1. Here you have a closer relationship with your mother at the expense of either your dad or your brother. who is in the outside position in the triangle. You are allied with your mother in a blaming position toward another family member. Position two. Here, your mother will feel like the outsider in the triangle, and she may redirect her anger toward you for not supporting her or not seeing the truth about your father or your brother. You are in a blaming position toward your mother and a rescuing position toward the other party. Position three. Here you try to help both parties and be a therapist in your own family, which is not possible. Your mother will either ignore your advice or tell you why it won't work. You are in a fix-it or peacemaking position in the triangle. Position four. Here you try to lower your stress level by avoiding your mother, resolving nothing in the long run, and ensuring that the underground anger and intensity will emerge elsewhere. You are in a blaming and distancing position toward your mother in the triangle. None of the above positions is inherently troublesome if it is flexible and temporary. As the Kessler family illustrates, however, positions in a family triangle can become rigid and fixed. As daughters, we're frequently participating in a triangle with our mother and one other family member. Our father, if our parents are legally but not emotionally divorced, this triangle may be especially intense. Our mother's mother or a sibling. As long as we take part in this triangle, our relationship with our mother is heavily influenced by her relationship with the other party. And our relationship with the other party is heavily influenced by that person's relationship with our mother. In fact, every relationship on all three sides of the triangle is influenced by issues from another relationship. When triangles heat up, a lot of anger and stress may fly around. But salient issues do not get clarified or resolved. Remember also, a triangle is not something that another person does to you. Triangles require the participation of all three parties, and any one party can get out of a triangle. That is, if you can tolerate the anxiety involved in the process. If you could do some work on an important triangle in your first family, it will not only help you with your anger, it will influence every relationship that you're in. Do you want to give it a try? The first step, as always, is observation. Sharpening your observational skills. As you learn to observe your own position in a family triangle, you may want to diagram it. For example, when your mother calls and says, "Let me tell you what your brother Joe is doing now," you might participate in a triangle involving you, your mother, and your brother. When things are calm in the family, you and your mother discuss Joe's problems. The relationship between your mother and Joe remains calm and distant because your mother is lowering her anxiety by talking with you, rather than dealing directly with her son. The relationship between you and your mother stays calm and close as you focus attention on your brother's problems instead of identifying and addressing issues in the relationship between the two of you. When stress increases, open conflict may break out between your mother and brother. You may then take a mediating position in the triangle, trying to be helpful to each party. You may say to your brother, "Mother really loves you." To your mother, you may advise, "I think what Joe needs from you is a firm hand. It's not that he's bad, he's just testing the limits." Your relationship with both your mother and your brother intensifies, while the conflictual side of the triangle is between your mother and brother. If tension escalates further, the triangle may shift again. Your mother may get angry at you for not seeing the truth about your brother. Joe may get angry at you for not taking his side against Mother. And you may get angry at one or both of them for the way they are behaving with you or each other. All three of you are in a blaming position, and there is conflict on all sides of the triangle. Can you now begin to identify your own position in a key family triangle? Joe may be your father, your grandmother, your cousin, or your aunt. If you're saying, "This doesn't apply to my family," keep thinking about it. How would you respond to your mother's telephone call if your task was to move out of the triangle rather than participate in it? Close this book and get clear on what you would say before reading further. If you feel stuck and unclear, reread Chapter 8. De-triangulating moves. When your mother calls to talk about Joe, or he talks about her, you can casually show disinterest.
Remember, the triangles are driven by emotionality and anxiety, our own included, so that the more low-keyed you can be, the better. You might say, "Well, I'm not sure what Joe is up to. Beats me what it's all about. I just don't know what to say." To change the subject, Mother, what are you up to lately? When one party pressures you to give advice or take sides, you can do neither, and instead express your confidence in both parties. "Well, I don't have the slightest idea about what's going on, but I love you both a lot, and I trust that the two of you can work it out." If your mother's focus on your brother remains persistent and intense, you might address the issue more directly in a non-blaming way. "You know, Mother, I feel kind of selfish about our time together, and I'd like to use it talking about us and what's happening in our lives without bringing my brother in. I know you're struggling with him, but I don't have the slightest idea how to be helpful, and it takes time away from you and me. When I'm with you, I like to talk about you, and when I'm with him, I like to talk about him. Right now, I'm much more interested in hearing about..." In extremely rigid triangles, even greater directness may be required. "Mom, I just can't listen to you talk about Joe, Dad, etc., anymore. I love you both, and I need to work on my own relationship with each of you. I've no way to be helpful, and for some reason I just start feeling tense when you talk about him." The exact words you choose are far less important than your ability to maintain a warm, non-judgmental, non-reactive position. That is, you can calmly communicate that your relationship to both parties is important to you, and that you have nothing to offer in the way of help, advice, blame, or criticism as far as their struggle with each other is concerned. Keep in mind that changing a pattern is never a one-shot deal, but something we do over time. Getting derailed when intensity mounts, and then getting back on track again. Do's and don'ts. Here are some do's and don'ts to keep in mind if you're in a blaming position in a family triangle, as Mother is in the above example. It's not only hard work to stay out of other people's conflicts, it requires just as much courage to keep other people out of our own. These suggestions can apply to any relationship network that you're in. 1. If you're angry with one family member, put your emotional energy into dealing directly with that person. If your reaction is, "But I've tried everything and nothing works," reread this book and think about new ways to move differently. If you feel stuck in an unsatisfying relationship and you want to talk about what's wrong with the other person, talk to someone outside the immediate family who does not have a relationship with the person at whom you're angry. It can be enormously helpful to share your struggle with a close female relative who may have been through a similar experience, if you can steer clear of a blaming position as you learn more about how she handled her own problem. 2. Avoid using a child, even a grown-up one, as a marital therapist or a confidant. Don't try to protect your children by telling them what's wrong with their father, even if you're convinced that it will help them to know the truth. Children need to discover their own truths about family members by navigating their own relationships. 3. Distinguish between privacy and secrecy. Each generation needs its privacy. Siblings need privacy from parents, and parents need privacy of their own. Secrecy, however, is a cardinal sign of a triangle when it crosses the generations. Don't tell your father that you had an abortion because it will upset him too much. Don't tell your sister that Dad lost his job because she'll tell the neighbors. "Dad, I'm living with Alex now, but you can't tell Mom about it." We may have the loftiest motives. So-and-so just couldn't handle the information. But the bottom line is that we're asking one person to be closer to us at the expense of another. If you're at the listening end of the secret-keeping business, you can let people know that there are certain secrets that you're just not comfortable keeping. 4. Keep the lines of communication open in the family without inviting others to blame or take sides in your battles. It's fine to tell your mother or your kids, "Yes, Frank and I are really having a hard time in our marriage now. We have many differences, and we're struggling to work them out." This is quite different from inviting a family member to be your ally or take your side. Do your best to block other family members from getting involved in your battles. If little Susie says, "Daddy's just terrible to divorce you," you can say, "Susie, I'm feeling angry with your father now, but it's my job to work on that and not yours. Your job is to work on having the best relationship with me and with your dad that you can." All of the above are different reminders that every family member needs to have his or her own person-to-person relationship with every other family member that is separate from your anger and your relationship issues with a particular party. You may be enraged at your ex-husband or black sheep sister, but try not to discourage other family members from having the best relationship with that person that they can. Not only will others be more sympathetic with your situation in the long run, but you will be less likely to get entrenched in a bitter position in which your anger only serves to hold the clock still. Learning about your family. Katie's story, Chapter 6, is one illustration of how useful it can be not only to share our problems with other family members, but also to solicit from them information about how they dealt with similar issues. If you didn't do so when you read about the Kessler family, Chapter 7, put together your own family diagram. You'll be surprised at how many things, birth order of aunts and uncles, marriage dates, causes and dates of grandparents' deaths, you don't know. You may also be surprised at the connections you can make if you study this diagram. For example, you may notice that the year that you and your brother were constantly at each other's throats was the same year that your grandmother's health began deteriorating. Perhaps the fighting between you and your brother reflected the chronically high level of anxiety in the family at that time. The more you can enlarge your focus to the broader, multi-generational picture, the less likely you will be to blame or diagnose yourself or others. Many of us think we know our family background. Certainly, we all have stories we tell about our family to other people. Such stories may elicit their admiration. Your mother sounds like an incredible person. Or their anger. How horrible that your father treated you that way. Or their pity. What a terrible childhood you've had. We may tell these stories over and over during our lifetime, constructing explanations for things that we seek to understand. My mother always puts me down. That's why I have such a bad self-concept. However, these stories, including the psychological interpretations that we learn to apply to ourselves and others, are not substitutes for knowing our family in the sense of asking questions of our parents, grandparents, and other relatives, and inviting them to share their experience. Most of us react to other family members, but we do not know them. Give it a try. The typical amount of information on a family diagram includes the dates of births, deaths, marriages, divorces, and illnesses, as well as the highest level of formal education and occupation for all family members, going back as many generations as you can. This may sound like a boring and tedious job, but you may be amazed at what you will learn about your family and yourself if you go about the task, perhaps reconnecting with family members along the way to get the information. Don't write off your crazy Aunt Pearl or black sheep Cousin Joe as sources of information just because they are the family underfunctioners. Every family member has a unique and valuable perspective and may be surprisingly eager to share it if approached with genuine interest and respect. Is learning more about our family truly a daring and courageous act? Yes, it is. It's not easy to give up the fixed notions that we have about our family. Whether we rage against one family member or place another on a pedestal, two sides of the same coin, we don't want the stuck-togetherness of our family to be befuddled by the facts about real people. In addition, we may not want to openly ask questions about taboo subjects in our family, such as our aunt's suicide or our grandfather's alcoholism. The problem is that when we are low on facts, and when important issues stay underground, we are high on fantasy and emotionality, anger included. We are more vulnerable to having intense reactions to any of the inevitable stresses that life brings, and to get stuck in them. Remember that we all contain within us, and act out with others, family patterns and unresolved issues that are passed down from many generations. The less we know about our family history, and the less we are in emotional contact with people in our family diagram, the more likely we are to repeat those patterns and behaviors that we most want to avoid. Remember the old adage, what you don't know won't hurt you? Well, research on families just doesn't support that one. Rather, it is the very process of sharing our experiences with others in the family and learning about theirs that lowers anxiety and helps us to consolidate our identity in the long run, allowing us to proceed more calmly and clearly in all of our relationships. But my parents won't talk. Well, gathering family data is a skill that can be practiced and learned. How you do it determines what you get. The courageous act of questioning. Pick an emotionally loaded subject in your family. The hot issue may be sex, marriage, cancer, success, fat, alcohol, or Uncle Charlie. If it is a hot issue with your mother, for example, chances are you feel angry and clutch inside whenever the subject comes up. Perhaps the subject rarely comes up these days because you've taken the strong, I don't want to talk about it stance. Your courageous act is to stop reacting with anger long enough to open up a real dialogue on the subject by sharing something about yourself and asking questions of others. Your task in questioning is to gain some perspective on what has occurred in the previous generations that has loaded a particular issue to make it hot. Only by gathering the broader family picture can you replace your angry responses toward family members with empathic and thoughtful ones. Let's take a couple of specific examples. Suppose that one hot issue is your single status. Every time you go home, your mother gets around to taking a jab at your unmarried state. What is your task? First, calmly share something about where you stand on the subject. For instance, Mom, I can see that you're concerned about my not being married. To tell you the truth, there are times when I feel concerned about it too. At this point, I don't know if I'm scared of commitment, if Mr. Right just hasn't come along yet, or if I don't want to get married. I'm not clear about it yet, but I'm working on sorting it out. If you are an underfunctioner, guard against presenting your problem as if you are just a bundle of weakness and vulnerability. If you are an overfunctioner, try not to make it appear that you have it all together and don't need anything from anyone. Second, open a dialogue with your mother about how the issue of female singleness versus marriage has been experienced in her family. Block advice-giving and other fix-it moves by clarifying that you're not interested in solutions right now, but in your mother's own perspective and experience instead. You might then ask your mother any number of questions such as, I've been wondering, have you ever struggled with the question of whether marriage was right for you? And if so, how did you reach a conclusion? What worries do you have about me if I don't get married? If you yourself hadn't married, how do you think your life would have gone differently? What sort of work would you picture yourself doing? What was your mother's attitude about marriage? And how would she have reacted if you had stayed single? How would your father have reacted? How did each of your parents react when Aunt Ruth didn't marry and worked on her career instead? Who in our extended family has not married? And how have they fared in your eyes? Questions like these will allow you to break the old communication pattern, reconnect with your mother in a more mature and separate way, detoxify the marriage issue by getting it out from under the table, and learn more about yourself and your family history. You may also learn about alternatives the family has found acceptable in the past, and prepare your mother for a greater range of outcomes in the future. Now suppose that the hot issue for you and your family is your mother's ignoring your intellect and achievements and focusing on the successes of your brother. Again, your task would be to share some difficulty you're having in this area and then to ask your mother to help you out by sharing more about her own experience and perspective. What is most useful is to formulate questions that will allow you to get a picture of how the same emotionally loaded issue was played out a generation back, with your mother and her family. For example, write your mother a letter explaining that it's difficult for you to work at succeeding and that the reactions of others are often too important to you. Then ask, how did your mother and father react to your talents and achievements? Were you seen as smart in your family? Which of your brothers and sisters were viewed as smart or not smart? Did you ever think about going to college? What were your parents' attitudes about that? If you had started a profession early in life, what career would have been your first choice? Do you think you would have been successful at it? What might have stood in your way? How was it decided that your brother was able to go to college and you weren't? What were your feelings about that? What was it like for you to have so much responsibility in your family when you were growing up? Did both your mother and father view themselves as smart and competent? Did they view each other that way? If you develop your skills in questioning, you will find that family members really do want to share their experience if we first share something that we are currently struggling with and assure them of our sincere interest in learning how they dealt with similar problems. Parents and grandparents do not think to tell us their own experience. Instead, they tell us what they think we should hear or what they believe will be helpful to us. Unless you're a good questioner, members of the previous generations are unlikely to tell you what it was really like for them. A final postscript about fathers and mothers. If you take the initiative to move closer to your more distant parent, usually but not always your father, by sharing more about yourself and asking more about him, you may find yourself feeling a bit disloyal to the other parent. For example, the distance that so often exists between us and our fathers may be the source of our angry complaints. My father has no concern about me whatsoever. Yet we may actively, although unconsciously, go along with our father's odd man out position in a family triangle. Be courageous. Defining a self rests on your ability to establish a person-to-person relationship with each family member that is not at the expense of another family member who is in an outside position. Also, keep in mind that if a parent reacts with increased distance to your initial efforts to be more in contact, this countermove is an expression of anxiety, not lack of love. Hang in a low-keyed way, and stay in touch. Remember, what is important in the long run is not the reactions you get from others, but what you do, and how you define your own self and your personal ground in relationships. Epilogue. Beyond self-help. Defining a self, or becoming one's own person, is a task that one ultimately does alone. No one else can or will do it for you, although others may try, and we may invite them to do so. In the end, I define what I think, feel, and believe. We do not define what I think, feel, and believe. Yet this lonely and challenging task cannot be accomplished in isolation. We can only accomplish it through our connectedness with others and the new learning about ourselves our relationships provide. Self-help advice can be bad for our emotional well-being if it ends up conveying the message that major changes can be made easily or quickly. That, for example, if only you are motivated enough and follow this book carefully enough, you will achieve the happily ever after life. It is my hope that I have provided my readers with new perspectives on old angers. Applying even one or two lessons from this book can make a significant difference in your life. But we both know that lasting change does not come about in a smooth, stepwise fashion, and many of the women described in these chapters had the benefit of long-term psychotherapy to help them along. Self-help advice can also be hazardous to our health, if a do-it-yourself approach isolates us from other women. Throughout this book, I have stressed the importance of learning about the experience of family members and sharing our own. Now I want to add that I believe it to be equally crucial for us to connect with the family of womankind, to share what it is really like for us, and to learn about the experience of others. It is through this process of reconnecting and sharing, of learning firsthand how we are similar to and different from other women, that allows us to go beyond the myths that are generated by the dominant group culture, transmitted through the family and internalized by the self. Before the second wave of feminism, many of us suffered privately with our anger and dissatisfaction, maintaining a single-minded focus on the question, "What's wrong with me?" Together with other women, however, we could stop blaming ourselves and begin to bring the old roles and rules into question. Finally, self-help advice always runs the risk of fostering a narrow focus on our personal problems, to the exclusion of the social conditions that create and perpetuate them. This book has been about personal anger and personal change. But as feminism has taught us, the personal is political. This means that there is a circular connection between the patterns of our intimate relationships and the degree to which women are represented, valued, and empowered in every aspect of society and culture. The patterns that keep us stuck in our close relationships derive their shape and form from the patterns of a stuck society. For this reason, it is not sufficient for individual women to learn to move differently in personal relationships. If we do not also challenge and change the societal institutions that keep women in a subordinate and de-selfed position outside the home, what goes on inside the home will continue to be problematic for us all. I believe that women today are nothing short of pioneers in the process of personal and social change. And pioneers we must be. For as we use our anger to create new, more functional relationship patterns, we may find that we have no models to follow. Whether the problem we face is a marital battle or the escalating nuclear arms race, women and men both have a long legacy of blaming people rather than understanding patterns. Our challenge is to listen carefully to our own anger and use it in the service of change, while we hold tight to all that is valuable in our female heritage and tradition. If we can do this, we will surely make the best of pioneers.
The End. You've been listening to The Dance of Anger, A Woman's Guide to Changing the Patterns of Intimate Relationships by Dr. Harriet Lerner, narrated by Barbara Caruso. This book is copyrighted 1985 by Harriet G. Lerner. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, 30 True Things You Need to Know Now, by Gordon Livingston, M.D., narrated by James Jenner. Full of things we may know but have not articulated to ourselves, this book is a gentle and generous alternative to the trial-and-error learning that makes wisdom such an expensive commodity. For everyone who feels a sense of urgency that the clock ticks and we still aren't the person we'd like to be, it offers solace, guidance, and hope. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to enjoy author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail, and thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.